Straight Up, the music podcast lifting the lid on your favourite artists with the industry insiders that know them best. Hosted by journalists Kathleen Johnston and Eleanor Hall.
Our guest today is Laura Snapes, deputy music editor at The Guardian and one of the best critics in the country. It's another fascinating interview. She talks about everything from profiling Taylor Swift at her home in Nashville to what it's like to have a male musician sexually harass you over an email interview before making explicit, inappropriate references to you during one of his shows.
Laura has genuine influence in the music industry, and that's not just as a writer and editor. Case in point would be recently when she convinced Matty Healy from the 1975 over Twitter to commit to essentially turning down any festival billings that didn't show a real commitment to gender parity. So if X percentage wasn't dedicated to female artists, then in future the 1975 won't be playing, which really is pretty incredible, I think.
That really is.
But she's one of our favourite commentators on music, full stop. So we really hope you enjoy this episode.
Laura, thank you for coming to the ministry to chat to us about music, and welcome.
Welcome to the ministry. We wanted to jump straight in and talk about your career. What do you think has been the most satisfying interview for you, like one that you've really come away and felt that you've got a sense of the person that perhaps hasn't been explored before?
I would say definitely Taylor Swift. It took like a year to set that interview up and kind of convince them to do it. And I only had 45 minutes with her, but I mean, it's
God,
really...
is that it?
Yeah, it's really rare that you get to go into somebody's house.
Yeah.
I mean, even kind of lower level like indie musicians. And so to go in her house, which still was decorated in the same way that she had when she was 20 and she hadn't changed it since. So it was very like fairy tale like. And, you know, there was like a huge birdcage above a koi pond and you could, like a human sized one, you could go up there and sit in it. Just seeing that gives you real insight.
And was her publicist there?
Yes, but upstairs, like not listening in. And the interesting thing as well was like the whole time, the whole process of it, I never had to sign any like NDAs and I was never told anything I couldn't talk to her about or ask about. And you know, she's known for having this very kind of like poised public face, but she was very unfiltered. I thought like you really got to see, or I really got to see, like disgust if she didn't want to talk about something or if we touched on something that she obviously wasn't into going into. But she was really
honest. And what was that?
When I asked about the Nicki Minaj situation a few years ago, she was like, oh, do we have to talk about that? I've talked about this. And I was like, no, but I'm going somewhere with it. And she was really game. I don't think she enjoyed all of it, but I felt like I came away with a different understanding of her.
Do you think she would have been happy with the piece? And is that something that you ever think about when you're profiling people?
I never think about that when I'm profiling them because it's not my job to please them. But I did get feedback and I know that she did like it. So that was nice.
So tell us about, because you've said on Twitter that it's not unusual for you to send, you know, a 1,000 word pitch email to the publicist, which, you know, it's impressive. That takes a lot of time. That's basically the size of like a comment piece that you'd publish in a newspaper. What are they like, your pictures? And for instance, the one with Taylor Swift, you say it took a year. Was that from the 1,000 word pitch email?
I'd had a couple of meetings with her British publicist just to talk about, because it was very much in the stage where there was no press happening, to talk about whether she would ever do stuff again. And I had conversations with her and tried to kind of work out what their concerns obviously were for, like, why she hadn't been doing press, you know, what Taylor Swift's concerns were. And then after we had met maybe two or three times, then I wrote this really long pitch saying, this is what I think is interesting. This is what I think has been misunderstood. These are the things I want to go into. This is the kind of piece that it will be. And so then I know that got taken back to the kind of main team.
Was it always meant to align with the release of the album, or did that end up just
working
out? We
didn't know there was an album coming at that stage. I think ultimately they were probably not going to do any press if there wasn't a release. But yeah, this was, like, I sent that email last August and, the August before. So there was no music coming then. That was like August 2018 and I didn't meet her till August 2019.
Taylor's had a tricky reputation with trust. I think, you know, sometimes people feel like she's not quite saying the truth, or she's leaving things out, or she's slightly twisting it, which, you know, we know that she has sometimes been a bit flaky on what she said, for instance, with the Kanye VMAs situation. How much did you feel like when you were interviewing her that you could take her word as it was, and how much did you trust her basically with what she was telling you?
I think anybody has like their version of events and you can push it a little bit. There wasn't any points where I felt like I was being spun or being lied to, even. To be honest, she was so scared of doing any press. I think she had done the Vogue one just a few days before, maybe.
And then she did Rolling Stone.
Yeah, and that came afterwards. I don't think she had done that. I think it was the second person that she had talked to. You could tell that she was just nervous and she was not in like public face presidential mode. Because as part of the run up to the interview, the only time I could hear the album before going out to Nashville to do it was when she did one of her playback things for her fans in London. And I was allowed to go to that on the condition that I didn't write about it, because those things are like sacrosanct between her and her fans. And so I spent the evening at this thing, and when she's on, like, she's really sincere and she's really nice, but she's kind of like presidential and goofy. And I didn't get any of that when it was just like the two of us in a room with her big fat cats.
Was it your idea to do it over in Nashville at that apartment?
No, it was just taking whatever we could get.
Was there anything else from her house that you did? You have, like, I would personally like need to go to the loo and then have a nosy around, lock myself in there, and like use all her products. Did you do that?
No, it was very much one room. If you've seen the documentary, it's the room right at the beginning where she's playing piano.
I love the documentary.
And the cat walks along the piano, and when she has dinner with her best friend. So it was in, it's like dining room, kitchen, living room.
And what do you think of the documentary and this like trend now for artists to create content, feature length content about themselves, and it ending up feeling a little bit like a hagiography at times, perhaps?
I thought her documentary was really interesting. There were definitely parts where I wish it had gone further, and things that I think it kind of skimmed over, and connections that the director sort of failed to make or failed to ask her about, especially with regard to how female power is framed in it. But I did think you really get a sense of what kind of the shape of the inside of her mind looks like, and what looks possible to her, and like where the boundaries are, and what she feels like she can't surpass, and what she feels now that she can breach, like with the political stuff. You know, I watched Madonna's Truth or Dare recently for the first time, because I saw somebody in their review of the Taylor documentary saying that this is like the gold standard of pop star portraiture, and it's unbelievably great. Like, the journalist has full access to her, and you just get to see Madonna being completely uninhibited, like kind of a bitch at times, and just like completely in charge, and she just does not care that anything she's doing might be perceived as unflattering. She's just completely herself. And so I think this has been held up as a standard that like all pop star documentaries should live up to. And you know, on one hand, it would be thrilling to see Taylor Swift behave like that. I don't think she probably does ever behave like that, but I think different kinds of truths are valid and interesting.
I was surprised that she allowed herself to be filmed realizing that she hadn't been nominated at the Grammys. Like, that is quite a vulnerable
That looked like she was filming it herself. I mean, if you look at the angle and the fact that it's a single camera, nobody's in the room with her while she's doing it. I think she's just archiving stuff. Or maybe the director had said to her, can you record like some key moments? Right. So she's in like her pyjamas, it looks like, in that scene.
Yeah.
And in terms of other profiles that you've worked on during your tenure at The Guardian, are there any other standout ones that you kind of keep going back to?
My memory is so bad.
You said you were quite frustrated with your Avril Lavigne one.
So that was on the phone, and
like the worst interview you'd ever done, or something.
It's definitely one of the worst interviews I've ever done. She just wasn't really up for it, or didn't really seem to get what we were supposed to be doing. Like, her new album has this whole backstory that she nearly died. She had Lyme disease, or she felt like she was going to die, and then she kind of found Christianity and like lifted herself out of this like terrible period through creativity. But she just wanted to talk about the music, and I was like, but the music is about this. Like, we can't talk about, like, literally you sitting down and playing a guitar, because that's really boring. People want the human stories behind it. And she was just snippy and haughty and just like taking the piss.
So awkward when you're on the phone as well,
and also when the publicist is listening, and then she goes silent, and then you hear somebody being like, Laura, can we move on? And you're
she taking the piss, like
just mocking questions, and like I was trying to ask her, like, take her seriously, because I think she deserves to be taken seriously, and ask her questions about like her past, and like as a teenager in the industry, whether she felt like she was respected and like looked after properly by the adults around her, especially when people like Fred Durst were joking that he had slept with her. She just kind of mocked everything that I leveled at her. Yeah.
What did you think recently then, when was it Louis Tomlinson, when he was on the BBC, was it The Breakfast Show?
Oh, yeah.
And he was asked about his new music, and he had two family tragedies relatively recently, and he tweeted afterwards saying, I really didn't enjoy that. And there was kind of a back and forth, because he felt that it wasn't appropriate that they'd asked him about, his grief, essentially. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's in line with the same thing? Do you think artists have a right to privacy as and when they choose, if it aligns with what the music's meant to be about?
I think artists totally have a right to privacy. I think there's also a time and a place to ask certain kinds of questions, like on the couch, on breakfast TV. I don't think it is a particularly tactful place to get to that, because if you're going to have that conversation, you know, if you're talking to somebody for an hour, it's probably around the 40 minute mark where it's like, we've established a level of trust here. It's private. Not just kind of like looking for a headline or something.
The album was about his grief, right? It was about his mum's death.
I think it touched on it, but to it. He, like, I think he's had like an extraordinarily difficult couple of years.
His mum and his sister.
Yeah, and his sister unbearable. Was in the public eye, and there's so much scrutiny on him as well. And I mean, when I interviewed him, they actually did say, the publicist said, like, could you not discuss it? Could you? Well, it was more about the sister because it was like literally just around that time. And I was like, yeah, obviously that's fine. Like, I didn't have anything like specific to ask him about it then anyway, and the like coroner's report hadn't come out and there was a lot of like difficulty around it, but he still was a very open person, and even though they put that boundary up, he was you know, he did share. Just
I guess that's an interesting debate though, like if someone puts something personal on an album, I guess fans and maybe even critics would assume that therefore that's fair game, like if you've sung about it, we're allowed to ask you about it. What would you say that was how you'd approach things in interviews?
I think every interview is different, and you have to kind of suss out like where people's boundaries lie and what they seem comfortable with talking about, and also frame things in a way where it's like, I totally understand if you don't want to talk about this, and you know, you should never be in that situation just, you know, digging to get somebody to expose like the rawness of their grief or whatever. You should always be asking that question, I suppose, with a point to sort of illuminating something bigger or kind of a more general portrait of who the artist is.
But have you never felt though, working for a newspaper or indeed other titles, that there is that pressure on you to get the headline and get the news line? And you know,
I mean there's nobody kind of like putting their foot down and saying that we've got to do that kind of thing. I mean, obviously you look for what's interesting, but also you have to respect people's boundaries. Like, I've only ever made somebody cry in an interview once, and it was a very startling experience.
Who is that?
I'm not going to say, but it was somebody who is very frank about a lot of aspects of their life. And I had worked out something else from the lyrics to their most recent record and also their presence on Instagram. And I thought, well, they're very upfront about this kind of thing, so I'm going to ask this. And they were so shocked that I'd worked it out, and they cried and they said that they didn't want this to be in the public eye because it would potentially like upset the happiness that they had found.
Oh,
and I thought, like, their happiness is not worth like 5 minutes of intrigue over a headline, you know?
And what do you think the role of the celebrity profile is now? Like, do we still need them? Like, what's the value?
Yes, I think we still need them because they are an art form when they're done well, and they don't just tell you something about like the celebrity that's being interviewed. Like, a good profile is kind of about the world that we live in, and like the person who's writing it, they should always be aware of like the links that kind of bind them and the person that they're interviewing, like the straight line that's between them and their interviewee. And yeah, every person that you interview is like the story of the world in like a bigger way. And so yeah, I think they're really illuminating star profiles. But even if you look over the last 10 years, the way they've been written has changed really dramatically. 10 years ago, like, hatchet jobs were more fashionable, the kind of thing where a publicist might ring you afterwards and be like, she was distraught. But then now, especially after, like, there's an American journalist called Taffy Brodessa Ackner who's like hugely popular, and she's kind of trailblazed a much more sort of like empathetic, involved, understanding style of profile writing.
Tom Hanks.
Yes, yeah. Really.
Oh my god, that profile made me so amazing. Happy. I was so glad that there was just like no angle, essentially. There was no kind of news line.
It felt
just
so reflective of him as well.
It felt
pure goodness. Like,
it was so
through.
Anti-journalism in a way.
Well, and yeah, like reflective of him is like pure goodness, and also how rare something like that can feel and how we're kind of conditioned to disbelieve it because we live in a really cynical age where bad people are powerful. So it's like, it's about Tom Hanks, but it's also about this other thing as well.
I read when your Taylor Swift profile came out, just getting the tweet up here, someone put side by side, your headline was, I was literally about to break, and then that Harry Styles' profile had just come out, and his headline was like, the eternal sunshine of Harry Styles, a former boy band hero, opens up about sex and becoming a 21st century rock star. And the person who tweeted it made the interesting point that just like, why is it that almost male pop stars are framed in this such like glamorous rock star way, even though obviously Harry's had his own like trauma and had quite a difficult time, and she felt it was unfair almost the way that these male pop stars were framed versus female pop stars. As in, not that your headline was wrong, as in it was more just like, why are you glossing over Harry's life?
Yeah.
And kind of putting him on this pedestal.
I thought that Rolling Stone Harry Styles piece was like a delightful concoction. It's like Candy Mountain, where you're like, wow, this is wonderful, but it's completely empty.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, ingrained music industry sexism and like the long history of male rock stars means that men are kind of automatically granted that kind of mythologizing in a way that a woman never would be. And their women are also held to standards that men never would be. Like, I remember around the 2016 election where it kind of seemed like a matter of global importance that Taylor Swift should say who she was going to vote for the presidency. And Harry Styles can get away with just being like, yeah, I'm really into expanding like sexuality.
Yeah,
like, I've got painted nails, guys. Yeah. And everyone's like, yeah, cool. Like, he never has to give specifics. They're not hammered for answers in the same way that
a woman is
or like made to account for themselves.
And even in the Miss Americana documentary, I mean, Pitt Taylor made this really interesting point that she was like, do you know how exhausting it is how women have to reinvent themselves every bloody 5 years? Like, do men have to do that? How many kind of old male rockers have had to do the same as, I don't know, like
keep on
Miley
existing.
Cyrus or... I guess Madonna or Taylor or whatever. Is that something you've thought about?
I think definitely at the moment, because we've got the Brit Awards is around this time, and there are so many men nominated in the mixed gender categories, and there's only one woman that's nominated in those categories. And if you look at the kind of pop stars that are being produced in the UK at the moment, it's all like men in hats with beards. They are held to
James's and Tom's.
Yeah, much lower standards than their female peers. And there's a music business reporter called Rhianne Jones who was covering this recently, and she said that she had heard anecdotally from people who worked at labels that the low level of investment that you need for a male star like this is disincentivizing the signing of female pop stars, because they usually, well, it's not that they need, but the industry likes them to be styled and have an aesthetic and
I've heard
be drilled.
I've heard something about that being a conundrum in America with like rap labels, and that's partly why they invest in male rappers over female rappers, allegedly, because the amount of money that it takes to put into a female rapper's career early on with styling and the videos and the wardrobe and whatever is so much greater
that's
that
so
it puts them off, which is crazy when you think about
it.
But I guess speaking of all of this, I saw your exchange with Matty Healy on Twitter, which Laura has basically managed to persuade Matt to, from here on out, post this summer, right, go only on lineups where there's going to be some pledge for gender parity, whatever that percentage is. You signed him up.
Yeah, it was quite surprising.
Yeah.
I have to admit, I tweeted that at him late night Tuesday, just being like, trying to push his buttons and see what happened. And then on Wednesday morning, he was like, yeah, I'll do it.
But you, so you and Matt are friends, right? Because was it last year's Brits or the years before?
It was last year.
He gave you a shout out on
quoted
stage.
You.
Yeah, I mean, he's very kind. I've only met him like twice.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But
how did you feel when that happened? So he basically shouted you out. He quoted a bit from an article that you'd write, kind of updated.
So I was writing, last year's Brits was around the time of the Ryan Adams scandal, and I wrote a piece about it, and I needed to say something that I'd already said better 3 years ago, so I just quoted myself, which is probably really obnoxious.
Do that.
But he read out that bit, like the requote.
What was the quote?
It was, I've got it here.
Shall I read it for
you? So you don't have to quote yourself. It was, in music, male misogyny acts are examined for nuance and defended as traits of difficult artists, and those who criticise them are hysterical people who don't understand art. Which is like so spot on, I think. Quite frankly, like, I mean, even here sitting in this room with three women, there are more women than ever writing about music. And I know you've said you think right now all the best critics are young women, right?
Yeah, definitely.
And now for a very short break to tell you once again about our wonderful series sponsor, Master of Malt. Master of Malt is a leading online drink specialist, and they sell everything from spirits to wine and are literally a lifesaver when it comes to all your hosting needs.
They are indeed. Master of Malt provided the delicious bottle of Alchemist gin. That's Alchemist, A-L-K-K-E-M-I-S-T, that Ellie and I drank during this record. And yes, I said Ellie and I and not all three of us, because Laura actually wasn't drinking at the time. So, you know, of course, we had to keep the side up, and
obviously,
it is our theme. So there we go.
It wouldn't be right without it. It was actually really nice. Very floral.
Lovely.
It felt like it had like some sort of like lavender in it.
Yeah, it was really, really tasty. And I think it would be really nice in cocktails as well, actually.
I think so. And did you know that the bottle is distilled by the light of the full moon? Whatever the hell that means. And you can buy it for £41.89 from the special Master of Malt straight up landing page at www.masterofmalt.com/straight up.
On our special landing page, you'll also find all of our guests from throughout the series drinks. That's including champagne, whiskey, everything from episode one all the way through to now is all handily listed there.
But you can say you can find all of our guests on the landing page then.
Oh, that would be quite good. But no, you'll have to go to the podcast page for that. Anyway, please do drink responsibly, and thank you very much to Master of Malt.
Thank you.
Lizzo and Billie Eilish and Rosalia. Why do you think that we haven't got a British act like that right now? Do you think it's just a case of timing? Do you think it's just women, like you say, not having the tools to get into the industry from an early age?
I think the British music industry is currently powerfully conservative, like depressingly conservative. This is like a conspiracy theory of my own making, but if you go back 10 years, although all these pop stars were white, you had artists like Florence and the Machine and Lily Allen and Bat for Lashes, people coming at pop from an Adele and Amy Winehouse, and people who are coming at pop from a lot of different directions and showing kind of like the multiplicity of women's voices in pop. A lot of those stories didn't end well. I mean, obviously, Amy Winehouse died. Adele went on to become Adele. Lily Allen kind of reached a certain age and became so gobby that the music industry disposed of her. Florence is now, you know, into her early to mid-30s. They all just got sidelined. And I think especially with people like Lily and Amy, I think it kind of disincentivized the industry to sign characters like women who would answer back, basically. And so a lot of the female artists that we've seen come through in the past few years, they just seem kind of malleable.
But then you see someone like Dua Lipa, she's one of the few people that's managed, she could have been,
yeah, but she was almost in dance pop purgatory. They like they were having her do like collabs with Martin Garrix, and then a hotel company said, we'll give you money to make a video for New Rules, and then that's how that got big.
Is that what happened? A hotel gave,
I think it's W Hotels.
That's
not enough. You're right, like what do you think it is that has allowed someone like even Mabel or Dua Lipa to kind of go one way, and people like Anne-Marie, Jess Glynn, and
I think Anne-Marie and Jess Glynn, I think, are pretty successful as well. But I mean, Mabel was a really interesting one. I interviewed her a few years ago, and she was just so switched on and sparky, and had like buckets of charisma and personality. And she's been quite outspoken since about like being told that she has to do things that she really doesn't want to do in her music. And I haven't watched it like up closely, but I've never really seen much of the young woman that I met in that room in the work that she gets to make. And I don't think it's anything to do with her. I think it's to do with the kind of commercial molds that she's being put into. And like with Dua Lipa, I think she could have been kind of, you know, left in pop star purgatory, but she broke through. And now there's a lot riding on her second album where she's kind of being treated like an artiste, not just like a pop star. But now she's the gold standard, and you see pop stars who are a year or two younger than her coming through and being pushed into the Dua Lipa mold. And like, there's just this horrible kind of like, well, we've got one of these, let's just have some more. And like you say, the female pop stars that are coming out of like America and Spain and South America are so iconoclastic and seemingly getting the freedom to be themselves that it's
so much more unique.
Yeah. You would think that it was somebody like Billie Eilish literally being like a world dominating pop star, that record labels, instead of going, how can we find another girl with like green hair who's a bit weird, they would recognise that what's made her how she is the kind of freedom of creativity that she's preserved with her brother, and that they would want to find other young women who are equally talented and nurture their specific situations.
I had some, I can't remember who it was that's telling me, it was like record labels and are being like, we need a young girl who's got like mental health issues, and like, we need to,
crazy.
They're like literally looking for almost depression to market.
Like, well, you get press releases like it all the time. So-and-so is really willing to talk about their bipolar disorder. Well, I mean, I hope that's on their terms, and I hope you're not telling them to do it because it's fashionable now and they might regret it later.
Beyond like much needed systemic change though, what do you think the answer is in terms of getting women through the door? Do you think it is going to take like disruptive artist incubators rather than the traditional mega labels, places like Platoon or Cobalt and stuff? Do you think that's a potential answer?
I guess on one hand, if you look at like the major label side of things, there does need to be a lot more like women and people of colour in positions of power in those organisations to look beyond the basic stereotype of what like the men who hold a lot of those positions now think is a viable prospect. But then, yeah, I mean, one of the greatest like disruptors, if we're going to use that word, in the past few years has been like SoundCloud rap. That's something that completely started under its own steam. And obviously that genre of music is inclined to kind of spread through those kind of channels. But I think it will have to be something that bubbles up organically and then becomes so big that majors have no choice but to hop on board.
Also, I can imagine if I was a young... Well, I am young. If I was a young woman, I always do this. If I wanted to make music, I think I'd be scared, because there are people like Dua Lipa and, say, Mabel, and this is absolutely no shade on them. Women should be able to market themselves and or just be themselves in any way they want. But, you know, they do prescribe to maybe kind of a more standard female in music image of you know, they're very standardly beautiful. They are, you know, often wearing tiny little outfits on stage and in their videos, and they look great and all power to them. But then there are people like Little Sims who I've interviewed who was like, labels were like, why are you wearing a tracksuit? They wouldn't sign me because I was wearing a tracksuit. She purposely wears suits and stuff to awards because she doesn't want to be seen in that way. And then Little Sims is someone that I feel so sad for, that she hasn't been recognized in the mainstream until like this year, and even then not enough, because I think she's fucking amazing. But I guess that's why Billie's so important. She's one of the few mainstream female artists that is totally able to kind of not conform to, I guess, what women in music have been tried, you know, labels have tried to program women in music to kind of look like aesthetically.
Yeah, I think it's amazing how she's like obviously stayed very in control of her image and yeah, like really kind of bent the industry to her will. I'm interested in what's happening with her at this moment, like doing a very stately Beatles cover at the Oscars and doing the Bond theme, which is also
released
very
tonight.
Stately.
Well, it will be when this is out.
Yeah, I think that's what she'll perform at the Brits, which will be.
Yeah, I should think so. I mean, I've heard it, and it sounds like her because it's her voice, but production-wise, it doesn't sound like her. It sounds like a James Bond
all
song.
Soaring, cinematic.
Yeah, and it makes me worry stories. That, you know, this person who's been building in music for 5 years since she was 13. Now there's kind of so much momentum around her, it sort of feels, I mean, I hope that she's still in control of this, but it sort of feels like the people that she's working with are like, we've got to get you across all bases, appeal to like the mums and dads as well. But I think, I mean, going by the Guardian commenters, who usually absolutely hate pop, and they're all like older people, and the fact that my mum rang me last week to be, and she doesn't like pop music at all, or any music, and she was like, do you know who Billie Eilish is? She's really good. Like, she was already reaching those people. They don't have to kind of do the sort of grand, solemn, grown-up thing.
Do you think she's the best pop star in the world right now?
What, like, personally?
Yeah.
I think she's really interesting. I think she's definitely the biggest and most significant pop star in the world right now. I can't say I listen to her music tons. I think it's really good, but it's also, like,
not your vibe.
Not really for me. Like, I think the production's really good, and I love the way she sings, and think she's really inventive, but that sort of like slightly gothy thing has just never really been my bag.
So what do you think? Was it you that chose Lana Del Rey's album for the Guardian's Best Album of the Decade, or was it a team choice? How does that work?
Oh, so that was just our album of the year last year. So that's voted for by like 50 of us altogether, staff and writers, and there's a lot of detailed spreadsheeting going on. I didn't choose it. It was like genuinely the winner of the vote within about, I think we had the vote open for about 3 weeks. Within 2 days of the vote being open, it was very clear that she had run away with it. Amazing. Like, nobody was coming close. It's not my album of last year, but it was really fun to write about.
What was your album of last year?
Oh my God, I've forgotten already. Bill Callahan.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Do you get to always choose who you want to write about, or do you have to do profiles because that's, you know, the Guardian has to cover them? How?
No, I think we always get to choose. Like, we are the music desk, and our print section is what comes out on Friday. Obviously other bits of the paper do music as well, like all of the supplements, and if there's something very newsy happening in music, then the shortcuts pages in G2 will sometimes ask us to do stuff. But you get asked to do things you don't always want to do, but you can usually say no. But sometimes it's fun to do things that you instinctively think, oh, I wouldn't want to do that.
Has there been someone that you've tried to profile forever and that they've never said yes?
Well, more recently Grimes. It's just not doing any press.
She just won't do it.
No, although I think that there is one piece coming out, but I think the circumstances in which that piece were conducted is not a celebrity profile, it's PR.
In the Tesla office or something.
Yeah. That would be great inside going to Tesla with her. So I was annoyed that she didn't do any press around her new album.
What's been a particularly challenging experience for you, if you could highlight one? I know there was, I mean, speaking of, you know, how you can both see gender inequality in the music industry, but perhaps as a female journalist, is it something that you've experienced on the other side?
As an interviewer?
Yeah.
The only time when it's happened was with this guy called Mark Kozlik, who was in a band called Red House Painters, and it wasn't face-to-face or even on the phone, because he won't do interviews that way. He only does them by email. So this was like 5 years ago now. This is the piece that quote that Matt Healy read out comes from originally. So I sent my email questions. They were very earnest and well-researched. And then what came back via the publicist, and I don't know why the publicist didn't read them and just tell me he didn't want to do it. But the answers that were sent back were very personally insulting, which was really weird. And they're patronising and kind of sexual and weird and implying that I'd want to have sex with him. That was pretty bad.
That is so weird. And they were that would be completely down. Awful in any context. But to write them down and email them to someone and then go past the publicist,
yeah.
That's mental.
Yeah, yeah. Like this Kozlik had talked about like being in poor health at some point. So I asked if his health was better and he said that he was raring to go and I'd be like a cat in heat when I saw him.
Oh, sounds a bit like Slow Tie last night.
And then, so this was, I think the piece was being written to time with like the release of his new album or like a UK tour, which I had intended to go to, but when I got these answers, I was like, this guy is dead to me. This is awful. So I wrote the piece, and it was very much a like, let him hang himself with his own rope piece already. Yeah. But then I filed it and it hadn't come out. This was like a couple of days later. He played in London and I guess he had assumed that I was going to be there. It was at the Barbican, which seats like 1500 people, and he sang a song about how I wanted to fuck him twice to the audience. He's the kind of artist that people like to bootleg his show, so I got hold of audio of it and it's horrible. But fortunately I was freelance then, but it was for The Guardian, so I rang up the then music editor and said I need to change that piece, and they were great about it. They were so supportive, so I rewrote it and I won.
Did it affect you, you know?
It was,
how much did it?
I found out about the concert thing from another peer who was there. They sent me a text afterwards saying, I have to tell you something really terrible just happened. And I rang him and I was like, you just tell me. And I think I was up working late that night anyway, and it was quite rattled and hard to sleep. And it was just one of those, it was kind of humiliating. Mm. And just like the adrenaline of going through something like that, like, I don't have no memory of writing it whatsoever. And then it coming out and getting like insane amounts of positive feedback. Like, I didn't get any, you know, it might have been like 0.1% horrible response, just the kind of thing that you mute immediately. But on the rare occasion that I've been in that kind of like high visibility moment, it's just stressful anyway.
Of course.
Feel so exposed.
Yeah. Like, ultimately, I do wish it hadn't happened, but then also, if I just like to be completely honest about it, like, I got loads of career opportunities off the back of it. And I'm not saying that in a like, well, silver linings kind of way, but it was like a game changing moment, but as horrible as it was.
Talking about the relationship between, I guess, critics and artists, there have been several occasions this year where big artists have like taken issue with musicians' reviews, for instance, like Lizzo, who I love. So I was sad to see her do this, but she said, you know, anyone that hasn't made music shouldn't be able to write about music. I think she was taking issue with the Pitchfork review.
It's like Ann Powers and Lana Del Rey.
Lana Del Rey, and Ann Powers is like a brilliant, very well-respected journalist. And she made the point that, like, if a critic has taken time out of their day, as Ann Powers did, to write something like 1,000 words on your piece, like, that is so flattering. And it wasn't a hatchet job. It was like,
no, it was really balanced.
Yeah. And I think there was another one. Ariana Grande called out a fan. Well, it's not a music critic, but she called out a fan for having an opinion, basically. And Nicki Minaj trolled that journalist for just basically saying, I think it'd be great if you should kind of change your lyrics and kind of evolved with you becoming an older woman. Do you think this is... Yeah, how does it affect you as a critic, knowing that you might get basically, like, trolled by fandoms?
Personally, I don't care. You can just log out of Twitter. I know other people do find it harder. I've been on the internet a really long time and just have a probably terrible thick skin for this kind of thing. I don't think you should ever let the awareness that the artist is going to read what you write or the fans are going to read what you write stop you from writing what you want to. But I mean, obviously, you shouldn't be writing like awfully personal things about somebody. You should still be doing criticism responsibly, but I think you have not that I think it's some kind of like great noble art form or whatever, but I do think it's important because it's like the record of our times. I think you should be honest about stuff and you can't fear that feedback loop because otherwise you're just kind of compromise on what you want to say.
What about from the One Direction when you did that Liam Payne review?
Oh, LP1, that made me laugh so much.
We quoted
much.
You
that
actually. Kathleen quoted you in your...
That was my favourite piece, though. It's just so funny.
Sexual piranha.
The most embarrassing thing for Liam Payne is that I got no grief out of that, and even his fans were just like, even we're embarrassed, this album sucks.
That's actually so funny.
Like, out of thousands and thousands of replies, maybe 20 people were like, oh, you're such a bitch. Oh, I hope you rot in hell.
That is nothing for a next One Directioner.
Really sad.
Oh my God, they were probably embarrassed for him then. Okay.
Yeah, that's so funny. I felt a bit bad for him.
And who are the artists that you've got on your radar at the moment?
Well, album's coming out soon that I'm really excited by. I really love the new Waxahachie album. I've always thought that she was like good, and I've been into her, but the new one is like a cut above. It's like young Lucinda Williams kind of thing. That's really great. I really like the Beatrice Dillon album that just came out. I don't really know how to talk about that because it's electronic music and that is not something I write about. I had a bath to it the weekend. What else? God, my memory is so bad.
How often do you go to shows?
Not as much as I should, because I'm lazy and I don't live inside the M25.
Do you remember some of your first gigs?
The first gig, whatever. Mm. The first gig I ever went to was The Cause in Exeter, and I was 9, and I was very excited.
Amazing.
What was the most recent gig you went to?
I think it was Porridge Radio at the Lexington a few weeks ago. I feel like I did see something since then, but I think that was the last thing. Yeah.
And do you ever get asked for advice from young women trying to break into the industry, whether that's as a journalist or even young female artists, musicians that you might meet through work?
Not musicians, because I have nothing serious to tell them. I have no musical experience. And also as well, these days, like, press does not have the clout to break somebody. Like, yeah, you get sent demos and stuff all the time, but even if we were to write it up in one of the limited slots that we have for new music, you are not going to make this person a star out of it. It will just come and go. But yeah, like, young journalists quite a lot. And if they're asking questions that I've like answered on the internet somewhere before, I'll send the chat, but I do try and help.
What's your go-to tip? Is there something you find yourself repeating over and over?
Read really widely, and don't just read what's being written now. Read stuff from the past, and read all different kinds of music writing. And if you're right at the start of your career and you don't know how to do it yet, just copy stuff. But like, the more you copy it, you'll get, not for publishing, but like, you'll get into the rhythm of how something is written and how it's supposed to feel. And then eventually from that, you'll kind of start working out your own style because of it.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
We've just about run out of time, but it's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, thank you.
Kathleen, we were at the Brits together, of course.
We were.
As usual.
Tell me
about the red carpet interviews that you did.
Oh, they were so good. Yeah, it was like really, really busy. It's always a bit mad with red carpet stuff, because at first it's really slow moving and you think you're not going to get anyone. And you're like, oh God.
Who was on your top three list?
I mean, obviously my top three were like the people that don't do the red carpet. So like, obviously Stormzy, zoom straight past. Billie Eilish, zoom straight past.
Was GQ
down.
Always like one people would stop for though?
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's the classic thing where the publicists like look at the signs, you know, how you have like your brand name, your title even like on the floor, and the publicist will come down as they're doing the interview at the top and be like, and GQ,
it's like the Love Island matching bit.
Yeah. And it is quite good. I think it's because they know, like, so for example, like a PR that we know had mentioned to me, she was like, I'm not having my talent speak to the Sun.
Interesting. Did you see this is like weird trivia, but Maya Jama's facialist Shane Cooper will now no longer have Gossip magazines in his waiting rooms.
I didn't know that was him specifically. I saw that like hairdressers and stuff had like made that pledge to say that they're not gonna
I think post Caroline Flack.
Yeah
so I think people are really taking a stand,
definitely. I mean, I felt that there was like it was really a very, like, you could feel the presence of the story. And like, it sounds really lame, I don't even know how else to put it, but like, when we went to that Women in Music event, which Cassandra Gracie guys episode, I want to say 5, but it could be,
I don't
four,
know
so
I,
check
I
that.
Even fucked them and up, I had two episode 6s
yeah
listed.
Well, we'll put it in the show notes. But anyway, she hosted this amazing Women in Music event at Annabelle's. It was Sony in partnership with Instagram.
Ellie Goulding was there.
She was
looking fabulous.
She looked so good, didn't she? And there was obviously a lot of talk about Caroline on the night, and then the next night obviously at the Brits. And I don't know, I felt like there was
even the way I'm like now working as a journalist, I'm like, do I want to write that story? Do I want to include that quote? Do I want to piss off that celebrity? Like, probably not, actually, if it's having that much of an impact.
Yeah, and I think really it's really good for people like us who work in the media and actually do have that responsibility, like, to think twice. It's all very well and good for people to think twice about what they're writing on Twitter, and like, you know, everyone has responsibility for their own social media.
Which is what Laura Stakes was saying in the episode.
Yeah,
this episode.
But like you say, when it comes to like what we choose to publish and what we choose to put out in the world under the guise of like mainstream media brands,
it does make you think.
It just makes you think, is it worth it?
Yeah. And also, I guess, I mean, it's like you say, we were speaking to Laura about it. And of course, like, a good journalist isn't going to ever worry about what the subject is going to think when they read their piece. But there is, on the flip side, like, there, it is good to acknowledge that there's, like, a human at the end of that. And that someone might, like, the journalist who you commissioned that piece for that said...
She felt guilty.
Caroline Flack had contacted her after
Yes, Rebecca Reid wrote a really touching piece to Telegraph about how she felt really bad for calling out Caroline Flack's relationship with Harry Styles and Caroline Flack while she was hosting Love Island, was replying in the ad breaks, like, why did you write this piece? And you just don't expect celebrities to actually read your piece.
Yeah, she was, exactly. And that's what I think is good, that it kind of changes your perspective on that.
Like, no one, like, is too famous to search their name in Google. Like, people do it and they get upset.
And they actually will be upset if you're being really offensive. But yeah, back to Red Carpet. It was great.
So who did you interview?
So I interviewed Foles, who ended up winning an award, which was nice. And they were talking about the things that they, like, love and hate about Red Carpet events, because you can just tell from their face, like, they're not the natural.
And
like,
they won.
Yeah.
Do you think they had any idea? So really cute.
No, I don't at all. I think they were like, you know, it's just nice to come, get a free meal, do some celeb spotting.
Wonder, do you know what the meal was?
Yeah, I do, because it's whatever we had in the... I realised I saw someone's Instagram. And, yeah, it's whatever we had in the box. It was the same
food. What
did we
have in the box? Great, there was some little cheese.
There was, like, some... I don't know, some kind of, like... I want to say it was, like, a beetroot bake or something.
I don't think I had...
I actually didn't eat anything, so I don't know, because I came... Yeah, I came
straight. Anyway, it was perfectly nice.
Who else? Paloma Faith, who was, like, wearing this hilarious, like, amazing big pink hat. And she was talking, obviously, about the whole like gender diversity issue, and she was like, you know, I feel like I'm like the spokesperson for this kind of thing on these red carpets, because like I always talk about
it. She actually wrote a piece about it, because her PR was like, do you want to publish this piece from Paloma Faith about Caroline Flack and women in the media?
Yeah, so was that the thing that she ended up like self-publishing on Instagram? Did you
I think
see
that's,
it?
Oh,
it was
yeah,
like a lot. It was like a piece that she broke had obviously broken up into.
So she woke up in the middle of the night and just wrote it, and I got an email from her PR being like, Paloma has written this in the middle of the night, would you like to publish it? And like, we just didn't have the capacity to publish it, but
interesting. Yeah,
like nice that she had that urge.
I
that
know
passion.
And then AJ Tracy, who I always love, like I always like,
what's he wearing?
He was wearing, I think, do you know what, loads of people were wearing Kim Jones Dior.
Why do you think that is?
Everyone's wearing, well, so Kim Jones obviously is the director of menswear.
Who do you think I am?
Sorry, just checking, you know, obviously, for those that might not know. And yeah, everyone is wearing Dior at the moment. It's really nice because they're like classic.
By everyone, do you mean in music?
I mean generally, like, I mean, so obviously David Beckham is number one fan, but yeah, in music. So like Dermot Kennedy was wearing Kim Jones Dior, Stormzy was wearing it, AJ Tracy was wearing.
Who does Stormzy usually wear?
I don't know, but he was obviously wearing the like jumper trousers combo.
Everyone was saying he looked like Frozo.
Like who?
Frozo from the Incredibles. With the
oh
white,
my god!
And I was like, he looked amazing, but once you see the Frozo reference, you can't unsee it.
I thought he looked really good, but yeah, they essentially will be like a modern update on like a classic shape. So they'll have like a band of fabric like across the lapel or something like that. And AJ had that, and then like kind of.
So do you think we'll be hearing mentions of Kim Jones in UK rap? And same way that we've been hearing about Virgil Abloh.
Yeah. Oh my god, yeah, definitely. And he, a lot of people, what were they talking about? So AJ was talking about like the best party that he's ever been to, and obviously I was thinking he was going to be like, oh, you know, it was when I was like in Toronto and Drake was there, or like something like that. He's like, do you know what, it was actually when I was like 15, 16, and because I grew up in Ladbroke Grove, like all the posh girls would invite like the hood guys to their parties. So
do you know where I last had? So I was in New York visiting Issa, my boyfriend, and we were in some like a club in Lower East Side, like some like dirty club. It was like just like some small club. Ladbroke Grove was playing.
It's
like,
it?
What? This is like not a song I'd expect to hear in like
in America.
In New York.
That's so cute though.
I don't think anyone recognised it apart from me. And Issa.
Yeah. It's Georgia Smith that does the vocal, isn't it?
Yeah. But it just shows how like UK like rappers are properly breaking.
Getting so big
sticks.
Elsewhere, yeah. Mahalia was great. She was just talking about her kind of breakout year. She looked gorge. Her shoes were killing her. She was dying. They were like classic. You know, just like a shoe that has like a flat sole. Like there's no platform at the front bit, so the ball of your foot is just agony.
She's looking amazing at the moment.
She really is. Charlie XCX. H was on like a very good form.
Did you notice
obviously.
His glowing skin that I
yes,
first up for?
I did, and he was like, yeah, he looked really good. He was wearing kind of classic tuck. Loads of people were talking about Bond, obviously because of the Billie Eilish performance.
Yeah.
Johnny Marr was talking all about doing the guitar for the whole score, because yeah. I thought he was just doing the guitar for No Time to Die.
Yeah.
And actually, he's like done all the guitar for the entire film score. So
amazing.
That was interesting. And yeah, Burna Boy looked amazing. I want to say he was wearing Bottega Veneta, but it also might have been Balenciaga. I will definitely have to check that. I think it was Bottega.
Who was one wearing like a flowery thing that you said was definitely Gucci?
Yeah, I was actually wrong about that. That was Harry Styles. Harry Styles did wear a Gucci look, but then he also wore Marc Jacobs.
What did Burna Boy talk about?
Yeah, so Burna Boy was just talking. He was talking, obviously, about his look. It was like head to toe Bottega. He had this kind of wild, like really big turquoise padded jacket, and he was talking about his African giant like necklace, which is massive. I don't know if you've seen it, but it almost looks like I'll get up. Like it could. Kind of looks like a ghost or something.
It does, it
doesn't it? But then I was like,
it's actually really cute.
Is that just me?
What is it though?
I don't know. I mean, that's what it looks like to me. But it says African giant on it, and like,
what is that little like
with the
like,
little face? I just don't know.
He looks like a snowman.
I know. I couldn't tell.
Okay,
you
well,
that.
No shade on the necklace. It looks
no.
Great.
He looked amazing, and yeah, he just spoke about taking African music to the world and how excited he was about the Stormzy and Ed track and how well it had done. And even
I'm surprised he didn't win Best International Man, even though it was so well deserved from Tyler. I felt like Burna Boy, this is totally his year.
Yeah, I agree.
And he's not going to make, he just released his album. He's not going to make one next year. And he has added so much to the British music industry.
To like the sound.
He's just fused so well with it. Just seems, yeah. But anyway, they would have both be well deserved.
But yeah, they were good. But obviously, we were both there. Even better, let's discuss. Since we haven't even talked about it, after party.
I felt really
so
lame
fun.
That we only went to one. I felt like everyone else went to
all the
celebs.
Thing is, yeah, that's like, if you're a celeb, you're basically just like zooming around in a cab most of the time. Whereas actually,
I met someone that was really annoyed that she had her wrist, that she was given a wristband. She was like, if I was like famous enough, I wouldn't have a wristband.
Oh, interesting. Wow. Yeah, so it was at Chiltern Firehouse. This was the Warner after party. Universal did theirs up at the Ned in association with Soho House. This was with...
Someone else did theirs at Standard. Who
at the Standard.
That? Was that Sony?
It could be, yeah. Yeah, I think it was. I think Sony did the Standard. So, like, every year, for everyone that, like, doesn't know, the different labels have a really big after party, each one.
And then Warner... there's a super special one with Dre, Beats by Dre. Like an even nicher one where everyone ends at which everyone like congregates at right at the end of the night,
and that was the Dave one this year, right?
Yes, that was at Scotch.
Yeah, love Chiltern Firehouse. Like, it's just so fun always, isn't it? And it's so like the smoking area. For the people that haven't been, it's like you literally go into either the men's or women's, and there's like a secret door at the back, and you go through, and then you're in this kind of inside but outside smoking area, and that's usually where you can do like really good celeb spotting, because they're just...
Also, not to promote smoking, because no one should smoke, but they do hand out nerd. Free cigarettes in like a little tray.
Yeah, they didn't hand them out. There's like these trays and non-menthol. Little sort of treasure chests that are open, and they're filled with sweets.
I'm actually surprised that they are allowed.
You kept
to,
picking
like,
up those laces. Do you remember those red laces?
There was such great pick and mix. Yeah. Also, like the sherbet dipping.
I also found a whole pack. Like,
oh yeah, I told you to
pack
take
of
it.
Polos in
I was
my
like,
bag.
Take this pack for later.
You made me take
tube
it.
Of polos. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you just like all the cigarettes as well. People are just like grabbing handfuls of them. It's
I found a lot of like beheaded cigarettes in my clutch the next day. Like, clearly thought I'd smoke them another time.
But it was so good. Like, so many, like all the kind of faces that you would expect. Naomi Campbell was there. Maya Jama was there. Stormzy was there. Mm. Ricardo Tisci walked in. Our friend Zach from GQ. That was major.
That was
moment,
the moment.
Wasn't it?
He was like, he suddenly
Everyone.
Looked. They're coming. And then they did.
And
they
he
all
was
came.
Obviously with Irina Shayk. And then all the models came in after. This was quite late as well, wasn't it? This was at like 1 or something. I would
there was
say.
Great fried chicken going around. Great pizza. Yeah. Great espresso martinis. Great margaritas.
I swear that you weren't really. I had also a fun story. I don't know if this is true. So if it is, very sorry, not liable. This is a rumor. But I heard apparently the Chiltern team were fuming with Lizzo the next day because she'd been having such a good time with all her mates. They were all going crazy, dancing those, all dancing up on the bonkettes. And obviously she was wearing like really skinny heels. And you know how that's always like
Did
a 101.
Did it pierce them?
Yep, pierced them, made a massive hole in the upholstery.
Yeah, but they should fucking put that up and frame it.
I know.
The bonkette Lizzo pierced.
I know. Well, it's like the kind of classic thing, isn't it, that it's only ever like the big massive celebs that are allowed to dance on the bonkette because anyone
can you
else
imagine if we danced on the bonkette.
Oh my god,
that would be also like hideous for other reasons. Also, remember that last year when we went to the Chiltern Firehouse for the Brits after party, Lizzo performed and I didn't even really understand that she was like I wasn't even really like hugely aware of her at that time.
I was, just because I was really into that song,
but I wasn't a fan.
Yeah, I wasn't
like, I wouldn't cry at her gigs like I do now.
No, well, you're like super fan of the world, aren't you? So,
So I didn't feel like I appreciated it to the extent that I could have. Or was I even there?
It's just quite fun though, isn't it? I think the thing with the Brits is it's like one of the... everyone always says it's got like a notoriously like boozy reputation. I mean, we're always kind of working, so I'm never like going like really wild in that sense. But you do notice people are like sloshed.
They
like,
are sloshed.
All the celebrities are always having like a really good time.
Did you see any sloshed celebrities?
Well, I actually saw this thing, right? I don't know if you saw. So Young Ads, you know, from Depop Europe. So I interviewed them on the red carpet. And yeah, I don't know. They were just quite like boisterous and fun and being like, yeah, we're just really excited. And I was like, oh, have you like we've had a few drinks already. And then I saw the next day on Instagram stories, Young Ads had been posting about... he was like, I can't remember what it was. It wasn't a Percocet, but it was something like that, like some kind of like pill that he was taking.
Oh, yeah.
And he was drinking that like, you know, with the purple.
The codeine.
Yeah.
Codeine. Like, it was a Sprite.
Yeah, it was a bottle of Sprite. That was purple. So yes, I would assume
purple
so.
Purple drank.
And yeah, he literally the next day, like, I saw this picture of him looking like really on edge afterwards, like at the table, like kind of wide eyed and like gritted teeth. And then I think like literally a few days later, he's been like, yes, I'm checking into rehab.
Oh, thank God. That's just too common among
musicians. There was one tweet, it was just like a random person, but I thought it was like really poignant. She was just like, you lot like all think this is funny, but it's not. Like to go to an event like that, one of the biggest of the year, when they're up for an award, when it's like massive, like that's not funny. It's actually like sad that
that's not related to the cause of Juice WRLD's death, but Juice WRLD literally said that he was addicted to lean, which is codeine mixed with Sprite, and he had seizures, and that one of the main side effects of drinking that is seizures. That's why Lil Wayne had so many, and he's addicted.
Oh, really?
So
not to be the biggest Debbie Down on earth, but the final thing that I actually really wanted to discuss was the Duffy.
Oh my God,
the Duffy thing. So for anyone that hasn't seen it, on Wednesday Duffy put out a statement on Instagram where she basically explains that part of the reason that she was so quiet over the last 10 years after having like a hugely successful first couple of years of her career is that she'd been drugged, raped and held captive for a few days. I think she's come out with it on Instagram now because there's going to be an interview coming out in like an unnamed title. Apparently a journalist had approached her and she felt kind of safe enough to discuss what had gone on with them. But I mean, it's just like fucking wild, isn't
it? Did you listen to her at the time? So we were like young when she was releasing, you know, Mercy, Warwick Avenue, basically from Rock Ferry.
I mean, I remember her music definitely, like I was saying, every time I go past Warwick Avenue, I think of her. I'm like, oh, that song.
I was saying my rabies jab.
Yeah.
I'd just been mauled by two dogs and was in the London.
Yeah, I can't believe that happened to you still.
Caesars on Warwick Avenue.
But yeah, it's crazy, isn't it? Because she was around when she was doing really well. It was that kind of golden era of like young British women with killer voices doing insanely well. It was her, Amy Winehouse, Adele.
So Amy Winehouse had already broken and was huge, but Adele was... just kind of getting, she was just signed at the same time as Duffy.
Oh yeah, literally. So the Times ran with a story that was from their rock critic, which was Will Hodgkinson, which was like, in 2009 Duffy was a far bigger star than Adele.
Interesting.
And
because actually, so I was listening to her again today, and her voice is less,
it's so unique, isn't
it's
it?
So unique, but it is less kind of mind-blowing than Adele's.
Yeah, it's a different kind of thing.
Not that makes it any less good, it's just different.
It's not like the power, like, well, no, maybe that's the wrong way to put it, because it is, I guess, Adele's is more like cinematic vintage, in scope almost, isn't it?
But Duffy's has almost got that kind of old vintage school, feel. 100%,
I know exactly what you mean. But it's mad, because like, I'd always wondered, how could she have done so well? Like, she won what? Like, she won Brit, she won Grammys for her first album, and then she just kind of disappeared, and I always like, I mean, not that, you know, I'm not saying like, oh, I'd had sleepless nights over it, but I had always thought like, oh, whatever the fuck happened to Duffy.
So she broke, I just know that she broke up with her whole management, her co-writers, her producers after her debut album.
Really?
And they had this like big falling out, and so her second album, which was released 2 years later, Endlessly it was called, totally tanked, but she released it completely independently.
Okay, I did not know that.
Well, so sorry, independently as in without that whole team. I think it was still released via label, but yeah, so I wonder if maybe being that isolated and having that,
maybe there was
pressure,
some kind of relationship between like what had happened to her and the reason that she like fell out with her whole team. I mean, it's crazy because like we just don't know. It would be so interesting to see whether it was something that happened before or after she was famous, like that we have no context for me. But
there's
I feel
been
so
some
sorry
really,
for her. I mean,
yes,
like,
so do
for
I.
Me, that is just...
There have been some really horrible backlash, like, obviously, there have
I mean,
been
of
trolls
course, like,
saying, like, oh, she's obviously about to release a new album, which she is, so this is all just part of the promo.
I mean, no one would lie about that. Like, there's just no fucking way.
It's so mental. It's like a scene out of Room, that film.
Yeah, and it was really... I really rate her, though. I mean, I guess, you know, how else do you say it, I guess, but the kind of clarity and brevity of the way she said it, when she's like, I was drugged, raped and held captive, like, it sounds kind of stark, but that really is what happens. There's no other way to say it. Like, I think that does so much, again, for female survivors, or, you know, survivors of any gender, but it's just...
And the way she was really like, important. Please, like, be gentle with me and be kind to me, which I feel was actually very relevant to the way the media have kind of had a dressing down post-Caroline.
Yeah, but well, the whole thing is be kind, isn't it? That's like the hashtag that's trending. Everyone's like,
I think people will be way kinder because of what happened to Caroline.
Because surely, yeah, they're not going to have like the gall to...
But like still some mentalists like replied to her being like, oh, you know, like, it's not really that brave if you didn't come forward at the time. Like, why didn't you go to the police?
Why do you care? People are such freaks. I just can't cope.
Literally, I don't think I could go to the police if that happened to me. I'd be so
I mean, well, we don't know what the context is. I mean, she probably did go to the police. Like,
well, that exactly.
We have no idea what the story is. It's just classic. These people that have fucking way too much time on their hands and way too eager to get onto Twitter and give someone a piece of, like, their mind when actually they don't know what the fuck they're talking about.
Literally.
Over it.
Anyway, well,
but yes, very
well, bright, I hope she's okay.
Bright and
well, anyway, she says the sun that she is okay now.
Yeah, she
said
that she's
happy.
At peace with it, right? And that's the thing, like, even if social media isn't, like, she's at peace with it. That's why she's come out with it after this long.
Do you think the album will be about that?
Maybe.
What was very interesting was what she said in her Instagram was like, this was real trauma, so I couldn't sing about it because it was so real,
so painful that you can't even, it's not like a breakup or
which
something,
makes you which is so different. Does that, like, is that different therefore to the trauma that we hear in songs?
Like, I mean, it's a whole new level, isn't it? I guess it's not like identifiable trauma that's like more everyday and it's ordinariness. Like, that doesn't happen to very many people.
I guess we've never heard anyone sing about sexual assault.
Yeah, I mean, it's just not something
you hear about heartbreak.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'll look forward to reading the interview for sure, and I think good on her for
so will I. Really looking forward to reading that. Well, that's all we've got time for today. Kathleen, roll on with the credits.
I will indeed. Our music and editing is done by musician and podcast producer Marlon Percy, who you can find on Instagram at Marlon Percy. Straight Up is recorded at London's Club and co-working space The Ministry by the wonderful Chris Bailey from The Boy in the Corner, who you can find on Twitter at CornerHQ.
I am on Ellie Halls 1 on Instagram and on Eleanor Halls 1 on the more professional Twitter. And Kathleen, I just don't know.
I'm Kathleen.m.johnston on Instagram, and you'll find me on Twitter at KMEJohnston. Yeah. Please do, I know we sound like a broken record, but go rate, review and subscribe, because it makes such a difference for new podcasts. It really does help to boost us in the charts and make other people know that we exist. So please do it.
Yeah.